Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Food prices at the nation's supermarkets continue to go up faster and higher than expected. Proof of that in USDA's newly revised, newly raised food price forecast. USDA economist Matt McLaughlin and his crew now projecting prices at the grocery store to average up to 9.5% higher than last year. Lots of reasons for it.
High energy costs, energy prices have increased about 35% over the last 12 months. We have large increases in wheat, corn, and soy prices. Across the board, it seems like shipping congestion, so this can be either with transportation, with trucking, and port congestion, still remains a challenge for a lot of these agricultural commodities.
McLaughlin says those are just a few of the factors sending food prices higher. Gary Crawford, Washington.
This is Agriculture Today.
Chairman Scott, thank you so much for convening this important hearing to discuss Farm Bill dairy provisions.
Representative G.T. Thompson from Pennsylvania is the ranking member of the House Ag Committee.
Agriculture is number one industry in Pennsylvania, and dairy is our most valuable commodity. Our dairy producers have a huge impact on the economy and our Commonwealth, especially in the rural communities and townships, and I'm honored to represent. I'm a descendant of many generations of dairy men and women who produced the milk, processed the milk, and actually delivered the milk. But unfortunately, our family farm sits at the bottom of a lake today, thanks to eminent domain. But dairy will always remain a key interest of mine. I'm proud to say I've got milk flowing through my veins. And I'm concerned with the number of farms that we've lost in my state and dairy farms that we've lost and those across the country as well. From 2020 to 2021, Pennsylvania lost more than 200 dairy farms and nearly 1,800 nationwide in that same period. In order to stem this decline, we must have a strong dairy policies in place that provides a safety net to help farmers withstand the tough years and programs that help facilitate the movement of milk from the herd to the household. The dairy policy we have in place now is the result of an alliterative process. To be frank, Congress missed the mark in the 2014 Farm Bill with regards to the dairy safety net. I will say our committee didn't miss the mark. Unfortunately, once the Farm Bill, the dairy coverage in 2014 Farm Bill, once it went to the larger body, changes were made that did not work well, make it affordable nor make it useful for our dairy farmers. But since then, via the omnibus spending bills and the 2018 Farm Bill, we've made key improvements. And now our producers have access to the dairy margin coverage program, as you made reference to, Mr. Chairman, which has proven to be an effective risk management tool for dairies. In terms of the agriculture industry, I would argue no sector was as acutely affected by the COVID-19 pandemic as dairy producers and processors. Unlike many other commodities that can be stored or easily rerouted from food service or retail shelves, you know, dairy doesn't have that luxury. Unfortunately, in the early days of the pandemic, there were some tragic examples of farmers being forced to dump milk, but I credit the resiliency of the industry in limiting those occurrences. Everyone from the producer to the processor stepped up, and they worked overtime to find new markets or retool their production lines to keep up with the rapidly changing demands of the shuttered economy. And I'm proud of our dairy industry for rising to the unprecedented challenges and continuing to provide households here at home and abroad with safe, abundant, and affordable supplies of nutritious milk and dairy products. Unfortunately, these market disruptions had a negative impact on producers' income due to the changes made in the 2018 Farm Bill to the Class 1 mover. While USDA has provided some assistance to compensate producers for those losses, the 5 million pound limitation on assistance under the Pandemic Market Volatility Assistance Program left large operations with significant uncovered losses. In the past, dairy policy was regularly one of the most contentious debates during Farm Bill reauthorizations. However, in the 2018 Farm Bill, the dairy industry worked together to achieve consensus rather than having Congress fight its battles for them.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
You know, there's this inverse relationship between the value of the dollar and exports.
Dr. Darren Hudson is director of the International Center for Agricultural Competitiveness at Texas Tech.
You know, as the dollar increases, it becomes more expensive to buy U.S. goods, so we export less, and vice versa. You know, that's not a perfect one-for-one relationship by any stretch of the imagination. As you said, we're not near, you know, sort of all-time highs on the dollar. But it also is the dollar relative to other currencies, and so that, you know, the U.S. dollar is sort of stronger in that sense. And I think that has to be weighing on, at least to some extent, on, you know, traders' minds in terms of what the future of exports look like. Now, if you look at what is on the last export report, the relative strength in the dollar since mid-May, you know, that increase in the dollar hasn't really put a crimp in export sales that we can see. Now those, you know, we don't know exactly when those contracts are executed and that sort of thing, but I certainly think it can't, you know, the strength of the dollar isn't helping the situation, let's put it that way. And I don't know that it's necessarily the cause of what's happening here, but it's certainly not helping. And I you know, we're going to continue to see that. The dollar, I think, is in a stronger position relative to the other currencies. And I've said this before, right now the dollar is the least worse of the currencies. So I think that's the notion here. It's not that there's any particular reason, given inflation and all that, to think that the dollar should be particularly strong. It's just that the U.S. economy is probably performing better than a lot of places, both in terms of inflation and economic growth. And so that's why we're seeing some strength. But yeah, it has to play a role. I'm not convinced that that's really what's driving us lower on these commodity markets at the moment.
But what about current break-evens?
Cotton's probably the one I'm most familiar with, but I think in terms of the break-evens, I think, like you say, it's more or less a moving target. It's much higher than it has been because, the chemical prices, seed prices, everything sort of accelerated this year, along with everything else and inflation. And so I think, you know, the traditional idea of, you know, high 70s as a break-even for irrigated crop is outdated. My best guess is, you know, we're probably thinking at least in the 80s at this point for a break-even price, especially, it could be even higher depending on how much producers could economize on some of the chemical applications. And irrigation. Irrigation costs, of course, are going to be through the roof this year because one, energy is higher, but two, the water requirements because of the drought are much higher. And so they're chasing, you know, trying to keep moisture there and, you know, trying to keep that yield up. So I think we're going to be below trend yield, and so that makes that break even higher. So, you know, it wouldn't shock me if somebody, you know, called in today and told you, you know, said, well, that, you know, Hudson's an idiot. It's 89 cents. I have no claim to know what that number looks like, but it certainly, in my mind, it's got to be in the 80s, and it's, you know, it's probably at least 15 to 20% higher than what we traditionally think about as break even, especially given where the lower, you know, we're going to be on lower yield.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Let's back up to 2021, where China was really hitting on all cylinders. Buyers in Taiwan that compete for the same cuts that China does.
Yeah, after a slight volume decline last year, U.S. beef exports to Taiwan red hot this year. Joel Haggard is Senior Vice President for the Asia Pacific for the U.S. Meat Export Federation.
Hesitated a little bit, thought maybe that China buying spree would cool off later in the year, which it didn't, and so they kind of got left out. And then if you fast forward to early this year, I think they jumped in because, first of all, those buyers are very savvy. They're aware of the cattle cycle dynamics in the United States, and so they decided to jump in big and front-loaded in terms of their buying. However, demand's good, even though they're going through their pandemic wave right now. The supermarket business is on fire. Costco's really the destination shopping place for beef, one of our largest chilled customers. But there are other players there. There's some domestic chains, and then you have this meat shop scene that's really kind of developed this year. Smaller meat shops, some run by importers and distributors themselves, have set up e-commerce channels. E-commerce in Taiwan is not as developed as in China and Korea, but it's really gotten a boost this year.
Says retail demand in China for U.S. beef extremely strong, and smaller meat shops gaining traction.
In April, about the same time that Shanghai was locking down, the Taiwan government decided that they were going to actually abandon COVID zero and just encourage people that were infected to remain at home, but keep the rest of the economy open. Food service has been hit a bit because the older population is a little bit reticent to go out, but the younger people are still going out. So overall, the disruption has been much less than, let's say, Hong Kong and, of course, China.
So South Korea, the latest country to suspend or reduce import tariffs in an effort to curb food price inflation. Jessica Spritzer is U.S. Meat Export Federation Director of Trade Analysis.
We've had the announcement from the South Korean government that they would be establishing a duty-free TRQ for pork imports. So the U.S. has duty-free access for chilled and frozen pork through the CORRUS Free Trade Agreement that was implemented in 2012. And some of the other main suppliers like Chile and the EU also have duty-free access through their FTAs. But with our FTA, we are ahead of the schedule that Canada has through their FTA with Korea. So while the U.S. is already duty-free on chilled and frozen pork, Canada still is subject to duties on some chilled pork items. So 8.6% duties in 2022 compared to duty-free access for the U.S. And for other suppliers without any FTAs, so that would apply to Mexico and Brazil, there's a 25% duty on frozen pork and a 22.5% duty on chilled pork. Brazil's access is limited to just the state of Santa Catarina because of the FMD free without vaccination status of that state. So far we've seen pretty limited exports from Brazil, less than 1% market share in 2021 for frozen pork imports. But this could open up a new opportunity for them to gain some share.
Now, U.S. pork will not benefit from this specific action, but USMEF is encouraged.
You know, overall, we do see this as more of a positive trend with countries taking these steps to do what they can to curb inflation on the consumer side. Tariffs add complications for international trade, so reducing tariffs is a positive overall.
Jessica Spritzer with the U.S. Meat Export Federation, and this is Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We filed our beef checkoff lawsuit, alleging USDA had violated our U.S. Constitution for decades by forcing cattle producers to fund the private messages of private state beef councils.
Bill Bulliard is CEO of RCAF USA.
The court stopped one state beef council from retaining producer funds without the producer's consent. The USDA claimed the council speech was government speech, not private speech. But the court agreed with us and stated the USDA does not control how the council spend the money that it obtains from the federal beef checkoff program. Now, knowing it was losing, USDA entered memoranda of understanding, MOUs, with the councils to assume government control over their speech. And the court stated USDA relies exclusively on the MOUs to argue that the constitutional violation identified by this court in its first ruling has now been rectified. Now, this prompted us to take two actions. We filed a separate lawsuit alleging USDA unlawfully entered these MOUs without conducting a required rulemaking. Then we petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court because even the MOUs did not address the producer dollars that flow from the state beef councils directly to the National Cattle and Beef Association and the U.S. Meat Export Federation without government oversight.
On Monday, U.S. Supreme Court denied RCAF's lawsuit against the 13 state beef councils and the beef checkoff, so the ruling effectively ends the RCAF effort against the beef checkoff. 1 week earlier, it was Republicans of the House sending a letter to the president. The ranking member of the House Ag Committee from Pennsylvania, G.T. Thompson.
I was joined by nearly 100 of my Republican colleagues, including Leader McCarthy. thing I led it. We have Whip Scalise and Conference Chair Stefanik. We sent a letter to President Joe Biden, really calling on him and his administration to reverse what are overly burdensome regulations and policy barriers impacting American farmers, U.S. agriculture production. You know, those over-the-top regulations really have caused some needless uncertainty for farmers and ranchers and working families. And so the letter just outlined several actions that that the president could do immediately. Doesn't need Congress, and it would immediately help farm families. It would help to bring down in the near term input costs. Quite frankly, in the long run, it would make food more affordable for American families. Everybody would benefit. But you know, so really the focus was addressing farm input costs. You know, we did have information. You know, one thing in there was just asking for them to stop with any changes to the water of the United States policy change, stay really under the certainty that we achieved with President Trump with the navigable water role. You know, took a little jab at the EPA, encouraged them to refocus on science and sound science, not political science, when their decisions. And finally, you know, an issue that a lot of people have, you know, it's not the it's an issue that would have a significant impact on especially small, medium-sized farms, and that is the Security Exchange Commission, their climate roles they put, I think it's Tier 3 emissions role, which required data keeping and reporting by farmers on any publicly traded organization that they would deal with, buy from, contract through. Small, medium farmers do not have the resources to be able to be in compliance with that. So that was all part of that letter.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
If we were to use our tool on this side of the dais to say, what should we do to address labor markets? We'd reform our immigration system.
Representative Sean Casten is a Democrat from Illinois, member of the New Democratic Coalition. And during a House Financial Services Committee hearing last week, asking Fed Chairman Jerome Powell,
what should we do to reduce people's exposure to high-priced volatile fossil fuels? We'd make massive investments in cleaner, cheaper energy. What should we do in response to housing supply constraints? We'd invest in housing. I could go on and on. Everything on that list is deeply, deeply partisan because the markets are looking at the United States and saying, Do people in this line of work, those 537 of us who have the privilege to hold federally elected office, do we see human pain and suffering as a problem to be solved or as a frailty to be exploited for our political ends? They look at my colleagues who 2 years ago thought it was harder to stand up to Vladimir Putin and support Ukraine and say they're going to do the same thing again. They look at the talking points that all of you get every Monday. It says, talk about Biden's energy crisis, his border crisis. Don't do a damn thing. I admire your obedience. Do you have an ounce of leadership in your bodies? And so now we're left here in this moment, and I'm not going to ask you to opine on policies. I understand you can't do that. But you were so eloquent 2 years ago in saying, if we don't balance fiscal and monetary policies, we are going to be looking at a recovery that looks much more like the Great Depression or the 2008 recession, where it was a long, slow recovery. What concerns do you have right now if the only tools we use to respond in this moment is monetary policy?
The New Democratic Coalition actually celebrating its 25th anniversary this year, and they're committed to pro-economic growth, pro-innovation, fiscally responsible policies.
Honestly, as you can imagine, I'm very focused on monetary policy, and I think that the thing that I assume you're hearing from your constituents at home is about inflation, and that is our assignment. You know, it's not that we control all of it.
Well, I guess, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but we are. But when I talked to the CFO of a manufacturing company a month ago, and he said, my business school teacher taught me to do just-in-time inventory, and now I'm trying to manage the just-in-case inventory. That requires capital. We talk to chip manufacturers who are saying, I need money to build, but I need a labor force to grow there, and I don't know how to do that unless I have access to capital. Raising rates is great at curtailing demand. It's also great at curtailing supply. So what concerns do you have if all we do is raise rates?
Well, You're right. There would be supply effects as well. For example, to look at housing, you know, if housing starts, we'll slow down, and I get that. But ultimately, we have a job to do, which is to restore price stability so that the economy can function well. It's really the bedrock of the economy, and it's most important for the people at the lower end of the spectrum who are now seeing their wages and savings eaten up by inflation. So we need to do that. There's lots of other things that need to be done in the economy, and that aren't the business of the Fed. But we have that job, and that really is our focus, along with, of course, preserving a strong labor market. The two mandates are equal. In the current situation, the labor market is very strong. It's extremely strong. Two vacancies for every unemployed person, 3.6% unemployment, and wages moving up. So it really is a question of getting inflation under control, and that has to be our focus.
Again, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell at the recent House Financial Services Committee hearing. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Was a little bit interesting across the weight groups.
Caitlin McCullough, Director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center.
On the steer side of things, the spread between the weight groups wasn't as strong as it usually is. 6 to 7, 7 to 8, 8 to 9, and 900 to 1,000 pounds was all in the 150s. Sometimes you have a little bit bigger separation between those weight groups, and almost all of them universally were lower than the week before. Probably the biggest break we saw in Dodge City was the 600 to 700 pounds. They're down almost $20 a hundred weight. Now, the lighter weight animals were holding pretty steady, 4 to 5, 188 versus 187 the week before, and 208 to 210 on the 3 to 400. Another surprise, a pleasant surprise, I guess I should say, for the cattle industry was the fed cattle price. Friday, it jumped to 147.30, which in June is unheard of. This is an extremely strong price, especially given we are outside probably that 4th of July slaughter window. It appears packers are still chasing cattle to some degree. There wasn't a huge volume that moved on Friday, but generally speaking, this cash market on the fed side has been surprisingly strong. If you look towards the futures, there is some big, big discounts now in the futures market relative to cash. And those cash prices have just been very firm to higher through the weeks of June, which normally seasonally you would see a pretty big decline in here.
She admits volatility is everywhere.
Packers know better than we do kind of what their forward-looking contract and sales are. They must be willing to pay for those cattle at this point, even though June 1st was a new record high number for cattle on feed for the month of June. I think, too, in the futures market, there's quite a bit of volatility here. You have a lot of big reports coming out in the ag sector in the next, last week and this week. Acreage is going to come out on the 30th. Last week, you had cattle on feed. Hogs and pigs, quarterly hogs and pigs for June is also coming out this week. And these futures markets have really bounced around as energy and a lot of other things have just been extremely volatile. You have a macro environment that's causing waves that we haven't maybe seen a lot before, interest rate hikes, et cetera. That's causing some strange things to happen. Now, if you look on the feeder cattle side, on Friday, they were down about $2 in the two nearest contracts, reacting to an increase in corn. But corn, soybeans, wheat, all of those prices in the futures market have, over the last 10 days, really fallen apart. I mean, it's surprising how much liquidation has happened in those contracts, I think, for where we're at in the growing season. Now, the acreage report I mentioned was coming out. We could see some fundamental evidence that would support that. But right now, I think, you know, that 670 corn price for December that was listed on Friday is looking a little low to me. And on the soybean side, I was surprised to see us come down as far as we did as well. To that point, the cash market showed a little bit of weakness last week as well. Wheat was off almost $2 universally across the market, although you are in the middle of harvest. Kansas in particular is in the middle of harvest right now, and a little bit later we'll start here in Colorado. But all those things are playing into this market and making it pretty choppy. And the war in Ukraine and the energy market hasn't necessarily helped that. That's probably added to that volatility.
And when looking at boxed beef,
the history of the last couple of years has had packer margins really wide. With boxed beef coming down a little bit and fed cattle prices coming up, those margins have returned to probably pretty close to those historical norms. So any sort of price appreciation you see in the fed cattle side is going to push up against eroding that packer margin. And so the question is, do they continue to bid up cattle price even if we're expecting, we would normally expect, I should say, a decline in this boxed beef price?
Caitlin McCullough with the Livestock Marketing Information Center. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
One of the things that we encourage folks to do, hopefully before you get into a disaster, is to put together a flash drive that you can have in an emergency, which would have things like production records, production inventory, your vet records, your inventory records, purchase records of stored inputs, things that you have stored on the farm, things that you have that could be damaged and could have lost value.
On a disaster program tool, FSA Deputy Administrator Scott Marlowe.
You also want to, on that flash drive, you want to put things like your loan applications for loans that you've done recently, an operating loan, an ownership loan, your equipment loans, things like that. Anything that sort of helps to put out that full picture, as full a picture as we can, of what the status was before the disaster, what the status was after, and then also what the value is. So marketing records, if you sell into direct markets or anything, things like contracts or records of how much you charge for it. All those types of things can be really important